Chapter 17. American Kleptocracies. There are but two parties now, traitors and patriots, and I want hereafter to be ranked with the latter. Ulysses S. Grant. Trump's first impeachment saga in 2019 revealed a great deal, from smear campaigns and physical threats against American diplomats to Trump's use of American power for his own ends. None of it saved him from election loss in 2020 or from becoming the first president to ever be impeached multiple times, and none of it prevented Firtash from facing imminent extradition to the U.S., despite all of his efforts to forestall it. Nor did Kolomoisky's subterranean efforts to use the Firtash model for his own ends succeed either. Once Firtash's efforts crumpled, the heat of the impeachment investigations became too much for the other oligarchs following suit. By mid-2020, with everyone in Washington looking out for foreign oligarchs whispering in the ears of pro-Trump lackeys, Kolomoisky's path to the American president effectively disappeared, and it couldn't have come at a worse time. Because in August 2020, U.S. authorities showed their cards. Not only had they begun a formal investigation into Kolomoisky's American assets, but they'd already uncovered enough information to issue formal asset seizures against a number of Kolomoisky's and the Optima family's American holdings. With footage of FBI agents ransacking Optima's Cleveland offices, Kolomoisky was now on the receiving end of a tactic he'd so often employed against his opponents in Ukraine. Over the course of more than a decade, one of the DOJ complaints against the oligarch read, Kolomoisky and his partner Bogolyubov used PrivatBank to steal billions of dollars of the bank's funds. Backing up investigators in Ukraine, DOJ officials added that the magnitude of Kolomoisky's fraud and theft was so great that the National Bank of Ukraine was forced to bail out the bank by providing $5.5 billion in order to stave off economic crisis for the whole country. All of the details of Kolomoisky, Shokit, and Korf's efforts were there, laid bare in the allegations by American officials. Kolomoisky and his cronies spent prolifically. They purchased more than 5 million square feet of commercial real estate in Ohio, steel plants in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Michigan, a cell phone manufacturing plant in Illinois, and commercial real estate in Texas. All that Ukrainian investigators had alleged, all that Gontareva, who'd faced down death threats and arson attacks and hit and runs, already knew, was there, in black and white, with the imprimatur of the U.S. Department of Justice. And it came with the full backing of the DOJ's Kleptocracy Asset Recovery Initiative, which celebrated its 10-year anniversary by targeting the man who'd allegedly turned swaths of the American Rust Belt into his personal money-laundering fiefdoms. By the end of Trump's term in office, Kolomoisky stood adrift. The path to Trump's ear had been blocked. The oligarch's American assets were suddenly frozen, his network exposed. Legislation in Kyiv specifically forbade him from ever returning to control of PrivatBank. Kolomoisky looked around and appeared lonelier than ever before. Hemmed in by Ukrainian and American investigations, Kolomoisky had transformed from titan of Ukraine's oligarchy to instead a cautionary tale. And in early 2021, the Americans wielded their hammer. In a public statement, Washington revealed that it was directly sanctioning Kolomoisky and his family. As U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said, the sanctions stemmed specifically from Kolomoisky's involvement in significant corruption, with the oligarch leading ongoing efforts to undermine Ukraine's democratic processes and institutions. If anyone missed the move, the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv tweeted out a photo of Kolomoisky with a giant red stamp that read, in all caps, "Designated for involvement in significant corruption." The reason for the U.S.'s moves to sanction Kolomoisky was simple enough. A few months earlier, a new administration had taken the reins in Washington. A new presidency, pledged to restoring American stewardship and American stability, and to centering anti-corruption and anti-kleptocracy at the heart of a new American chapter. This book is hardly an exaltation of Joe Biden, or a defense of Biden's previous record. Given Biden's years of working as a senator from Delaware, such a defense would hardly be full-throated. Rather, Biden's rise to the presidency, unexpected as it was, points to the president's role as a vessel for broader anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy reform, and the swelling awareness of a new generation of American policymakers of the intersection of American kleptocracy and national security, electoral legitimacy, and the global tide of authoritarianism. The new president didn't wait long after the 2020 election to center anti-corruption as a primary plank of his administration. As he laid out in a piece in Foreign Affairs immediately following his victory, Biden said he would specifically single out corruption as a core policy through line for his administration, issuing a presidential policy directive that establishes combating corruption as a core national security interest. To that end, he announced he would specifically target illicit tax havens and expand American efforts to go after stolen and laundered assets. Structurally, Biden pronounced that he'd also usher in a new federal agency, the Commission on Federal Ethics, which would not only ensure vigorous and unified enforcement of anti-corruption laws, but would further be empowered to issue and enforce subpoenas and refer matters for criminal investigation to the DOJ. Internationally, Biden has singled out weaponized corruption, the kind that allows kleptocratic regimes to entrench and expand and enhance malign efforts abroad, as a non-traditional threat, one that NATO member states must focus on combating. "We will take special aim at confronting corruption, which rots democracy from the inside and is increasingly weaponized by authoritarian states to undermine democratic institutions," Biden's White House announced in early 2021. On their own, the pledges represented the most consequential support for a new anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy push that America had ever seen, or at least since the days of Carl Levin and his efforts to get anti-money laundering language into the Patriot Act. But Biden's comments hardly existed in a vacuum. Instead, they rose to the top of a chorus that was already growing louder by the day, building upon a nascent movement to reclaim American anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy leadership writ large, a movement that, by early 2021, had seen more energy, more excitement, and more momentum than any moment in American history. Because even before Biden swore his oath and entered the White House, Congress was already taking a momentous step toward ending America's role as the center of global kleptocracy. On the first day of 2021, the National Defense Authorization Act of 2020, NDAA, became law. Generally, the passage of the annual bill is a rote affair, shoring up American defense expenditures and offering pork barrel projects to assorted officials. This iteration, though, had one clause that stood out, one piece that made this one of the most consequential counter-kleptocracy bills ever passed. At long last, the U.S. would ban anonymous American shell companies. With the bill's passage, which overcame Trump's veto, Congress had finally, formally, forevermore, banned the formation of anonymous shells in the U.S. The anti-shell company language in the NDAA didn't generate many headlines, but it's difficult to overstate the importance of the bill, or of the ban. While journalists and pundits paid attention to everything else in the final weeks of Trump's presidency, from insurrection to impeachment, American legislators, with significant bipartisan backing, had quietly taken a sledgehammer to the edifice of American kleptocracy. "It is certainly the most significant anti-money laundering reform in 20 years," said Clark Gascoigne, who led the push by helping steer the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency FACT coalition, bringing support from across the political spectrum. "And probably the most significant anti-corruption reform as well." To be sure, the ban hardly happened overnight. Previous efforts to eliminate anonymous shells went nowhere, flaming out against lobbying from states like Delaware and Nevada, or from the Chamber of Commerce or the American Bar Association, or from anyone who would see a bit less revenue if they had to stop selling or using anonymous shell companies to hide their dirty money racing through the U.S. Nor was the 2020 bill a panacea. While those setting up companies will now need to identify and report the beneficial owners of the LLCs, such ownership information remains accessible only to American officials, rather than to the public, journalists, or activists. But those issues can be ironed out in future bills, because even without a publicly accessible database, the fact that anonymous U.S. shell companies are no more is itself a substantial salvo from Washington against the bedrock of transnational money laundering. For the first time in nearly two decades, the U.S. had passed a remarkable piece of counter-kleptocracy legislation. And for the first time in years, perhaps ever, the foundations of America's kleptocratic networks buckled. You'd be forgiven for missing the news of America's elimination of shell companies, what with it coming during America's first insurrectionist presidential transition, its first non-peaceful transfer of power since Abraham Lincoln in 1860. But the fact that Trump's failed power grab overshadowed the landmark passage of anti-shell company legislation points to a broader reality of the American kleptocratic industrial complex. That is, even with the ouster of a would-be authoritarian like Trump, and with the passage of the new anti-shell company legislation, the fight to end the reign of American kleptocracy is hardly tied to a single event, or a single president, or to his removal. If anything, it's just the beginning. There are a few areas of obvious, low-hanging fruit on the counter-kleptocracy front moving forward. The one benefit of surveying the landscape of loopholes and financial secrecy mechanisms remaining in the U.S., there's an entire buffet of options for reformers. And no area merits more attention than the decades-long temporary exemptions enjoyed by industries rolling in trillions of dollars, much of it anonymous, much of it coming in dirty and leaving perfectly pristine, leaving those industries now standing as the remaining pillars of the American kleptocratic construct. The first of these industries is the one that seems to connect all the kleptocrats who race to America for their money laundering needs, including Teodorin and Kolomoisky and all the others mentioned in this book: real estate. For real estate, the loophole was so huge you could fit a skyline through it, investigative journalist Tom Burgess once wrote. And he's not wrong. Thanks to the Patriot Act's temporary loophole, entire city skylines have been transformed into key ingredients in the American laundromat, including those in places no one ever expected, like Cleveland. We already know what the solution is: the end of anonymity, the end of anonymous cash purchases, of anonymous shell purchases, of anonymous purchases made via American attorneys who hide the identities of their clients behind attorney-client privilege. Time and again, in skyscrapers and condos, in McMansions and steel mills, in tired factories and entire cities, that anonymity in American real estate has fired the motors of global kleptocracy. For decades, American real estate has provided anonymity for anyone who wants it, for anyone looking to transform their dirty money into legitimate assets. It's a reality that has lined the pockets of the broader real estate industry and has had devastating effects on sagging downtowns and local communities in the U.S., and on entire nation-states abroad watching their treasuries and banks looted and laundered via American real estate. Thankfully, prior to Trump's ascension, the U.S. launched a pilot program aimed at fine-tuning the best methods of ending the all-encompassing anonymity in American real estate. Known as Geographic Targeting Orders, GTO, the program, first announced by the Obama administration in 2016, forced title insurers, those providing insurance to the owners of the property in question, to identify the real, beneficial owners of certain properties and purchases. As it was a pilot program, the GTO project only targeted a select few major American cities, including Seattle, New York, Miami, Honolulu, and a handful of others. The program was built on the same theory propounded above, that ending anonymity was the means to ending American kleptocracy and ending the real estate industry's role as both a benefactor and proponent, on a scale few could imagine, of transnational money laundering. Lo and behold, the theory proved true. Revealing the identities of those behind previously anonymous purchases lifted a veil on the owners and sent the dirty money searching for anonymity scampering elsewhere. One 2018 study found that anonymous shell company purchases declined drastically in the areas surveyed, even in places like Miami, still widely viewed as a city built on little more than money laundering. Even more remarkably, related housing prices dropped alongside by nearly 5%. It resulted in a bit less money lining luxury realtors' pockets, yes, but it was also the effective end of residential real estate in places like Miami as a sink of new dirty money flows. As an added bonus, it provided more affordable housing for the rest of us. All of which is to say, with anonymous American shell companies taken care of, the end of anonymity in the American real estate space must be the next major domino to fall. Whether that comes from the nationwide expansion of the GTO program, or simply from the elimination of the skyline-wide temporary exemption for the real estate industry, or some combination therein, is up for legislators to decide. But the towers and factories and mills and mansions of anonymity must reveal their real, beneficial owners, regardless of their connections to Ukrainian warlords or African oligarchs or mafiosi the world over. It's also worth looking to solutions proven successful elsewhere, such as the UK's Unexplained Wealth Orders program, which forces foreign officials to explain the sources of their wealth and face asset seizures if they can't. Once those identities are revealed, there should be increased consideration of things like a vacancy tax, specifically aimed at those who pocket these properties as little more than laundering vehicles, the likes of which we've already seen successfully implemented in places like the Canadian province of British Columbia. And why stop there? If anonymity remains the kleptocrats' asymmetric advantage, then transparency remains the best weapon in the counter-kleptocracy movement's arsenal. Such is the logic behind a thrust of similar proposals, such as the Global Asset Registry proposed by economist Gabriel Zucman. In hedge funds and private equity, in the perpetual trusts of South Dakota, and among escrow agents across the country, in all those other areas that dodged the post-9/11 transparency and anti-money laundering requirements, the time for anonymity is over. FBI and Senate investigators, journalists and activists, national security voices, and electoral security experts, we have all clamored for years about the need for the end of anonymity in these sectors, these favorite playgrounds of Russian oligarchs and corrupt Chinese kleptocrats and sanctioned Iranian officials, all those sectors that keep the engine of American kleptocracy running at full steam. As with the shell company legislation, the identities of those pouring billions into trusts and escrow accounts and hedge funds don't need to be made public, not initially at least, but their identities need to be made accessible to American law enforcement and to investigators from democratic governments elsewhere, including those struggling to their feet, like investigators in Kyiv who uncover Ponzi schemes rattling entire populations. They should also be made known to other interested parties, the pension fund organizations unwittingly mixing their finances with oligarchs' dirty money, the workers struggling to make a living at a mill secretly owned by a corrupt foreign official, the neighbors wondering why a row of nearby houses is always vacant, despite going for double the market value when they sold. All of this also goes for those in the art and auction market in the U.S. Despite claims from the industry that the American art and auction market remains untainted by malign actors, they maintain that the industry is just too niche or just too small to be of any interest. The kleptocratic examples have only piled higher and higher. There's Teodorin, becoming the world's greatest collector of Michael Jackson memorabilia, courtesy of American anonymity. There's a pair of sanctioned Russian oligarchs, moving and laundering millions, gutting America's sanctions regime, courtesy of anonymity in the art market. There are God knows how many other examples, all turning to the greatest unregulated market in the entire world in order to hide their money. Given that many of these requirements for transparency are already on the books, applying such transparency is far from the uphill battle it may seem. Nor is that pre-existing language in things like the Patriot Act the only card the U.S. government can quickly play. In 2004, in a little-noticed measure at the height of the Iraq War, Congress granted the Treasury Department the right to create a cross-border payments database. For all the reasons detailed earlier, internal lethargy, lack of resources, industry-wide pushback, the database never came into existence. But that doesn't mean it can't yet be realized. As Joshua Kirschenbaum and David Murray wrote for the German Marshall Fund, U.S. banks process trillions of dollars of payments per day, including about half of cross-border funds transfers worldwide. A database highlighting and detailing these payments, which we already have in places like Canada and Australia, would not only help reduce regulatory burdens on banks, but would also stymie kleptocrats trying to bounce their funds in and out of American jurisdictions. And as a bonus, Kirschenbaum and Murray add, technology would make an international payments database straightforward and cost-effective. The only thing better than combating kleptocracy? Saving money while you're doing it. Not all of this requires legislation, per se. For the American nonprofits we saw in the previous chapter, sucking up hundreds of millions from questionable sources, new guidelines and best practices must be implemented, with an emphasis on public disclosures of all donor information. And for American lawyers, long able to cloak their work for kleptocrats behind attorney-client privilege, a new slate of legal ethics rules must be implemented. All lawyers creating corporate entities and trusts or helping purchase real estate and luxury yachts should be required to flag suspicious transactions and face significant punishment if they're found knowingly aiding these kleptocratic networks. Legislation isn't immediately needed on these fronts, but if these industries continue to refuse reform, if, as a foreign policy headline read, U.S. lawyers remain foreign kleptocrats' best friends, they're only asking for legislators to take another look. Of course, even with the end of all this anonymity, this still wouldn't be enough. Asset seizure should continue, and even be expanded. But seizing these assets isn't a viable solution in and of itself, as only a tiny percentage of holdings tied to dirty money is ever frozen, let alone returned to the population suffering at the hands of the kleptocrats in question. Likewise, legislation and new requirements are only as effective as their enforcement, and if regulatory bodies remain understaffed and under-resourced, the new legislation and pro-transparency moves are worth little more than the paper on which they're written. Few things have illustrated this dynamic more clearly than the so-called FinCEN files of 2020, which saw a tranche of Treasury Department documents detailing trillions of dollars in bank transactions spill into the open. The leaks raised fresh questions about the efficacy of even the basics of America's counter-kleptocracy push, illustrating how overwhelmed the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, is when it comes to dealing with suspicious transactions flowing through American banks. As the documents detailed, numerous banks only took pro forma steps toward complying with the U.S.'s stringent anti-money laundering requirements in the banking sector. Some didn't even bother to file required paperwork on certain accounts until years after the suspicious transactions took place, despite increased regulations surrounding things like identifying those behind shell company accounts. The reason for such lethargy was simple. FinCEN, which was established in 1990 and oversees much of the anti-money laundering apparatus for banks, remained severely understaffed, scrounging for funding and employees. While the rate of banks' suspicious activity report, SAR, filings, has doubled in the last decade, more and more bankers at least seem willing to flag potentially kleptocratic customers, total FinCEN staff has shrunk by some 10%. FinCEN could barely keep up, let alone try to enforce any infractions. Small wonder that, as one source familiar with the document said, most SARs are never even read, let alone acted upon. Such staffing woes aren't limited to FinCEN, though. The IRS has likewise been effectively gutted, allowing America to bleed tax receipts and allowing the wealthiest among us to tuck their billions away without any worry about the tax man knocking. Not only has the IRS's overall budget decreased over 20% adjusted for inflation in recent years, but at last check, the IRS had fewer auditors at the start of the 2020s than at any point since the 1950s. Small wonder that white-collar criminals, American or not, feel little fear about potential reprisals from the U.S. government. Staffing up, then, is a must for counter-kleptocracy reforms. It's also a relatively easy turnaround for the U.S. For inspiration, all American authorities need to do is look at how the Department of Justice has recently treated the scourge of unreported foreign lobbying. For decades, the DOJ's Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, was an effective backwater. Enacted in 1938 as a means of unveiling Nazi lobbyists, sparked in large part by the secret work of Ivy Lee, the so-called father of modern PR on behalf of Hitler's regime, FARA requires all those lobbying for foreign governments and their proxies to reveal their ties and how much they're making along the way. Yet for years, FARA itself remained little enforced and largely forgotten, with only a scattering of convictions over nearly eight decades. It wasn't quite a dead letter, but it was close. And then, in 2016, the U.S. watched a whole range of foreign forces wheedle their way into Trump's campaign, with corrupt figures out of both Russia and Ukraine linking up with numerous Americans in Trump's orbit. People like disgraced former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn, people like former Deputy Campaign Manager Rick Gates, and people like the avatar of foreign lobbying itself, Paul Manafort. After the details of Manafort's foreign work began spilling out in 2016, FARA had a new lease on life, and more momentum than at any point since its inception. Suddenly, the DOJ devoted new resources and new personnel toward enforcing FARA registrations and to making sure foreign lobbyists had to reveal the foreign forces lining their pockets. Registrations promptly skyrocketed, a new team at DOJ beefed up compliance, and Americans gained an unprecedented insight into the machinations of foreign lobbying in the U.S. Paradoxically, thanks to Trump and Manafort, FARA ended up funded and enforced to a greater extent than it had ever been during its previous eight decades of existence. Finally, decades after Lee and the Nazis connived to secretly sway unsuspecting Americans, FARA lived up to its promise, which just so happened to jail a number of pro-Trump figures, none of whom had disclosed their foreign work previously. Ending anonymity, requiring greater disclosures. staffing up enforcement and regulatory agencies. These are all relatively disparate, diffuse efforts, but they can be, have to be, part of a broader portfolio of action, of a whole-of-arsenal and whole-of-government approach. If all this seems daunting, that's understandable. It is. But this call to drive a stake through the heart of American kleptocracy has a historic precedent, one, fittingly enough, found in the period that most closely resembles the American political moment at the end of the Trump era, the Gilded Age, during the end of the 19th century. The America of the Gilded Age stood saturated in wealth inequality, in rampaging monopolies, in the kinds of bribes and payoffs and endemic corruption most today would associate with the developing world. The height of the original Gilded Age revealed American capitalism in all its inhumanity and in all its corruption, much as the Trumpian age has revealed all that is crass, all that is corrupt about the American political system and about modern capitalism more broadly. And yet, just a few years after its height, the ravages of the Gilded Age, as well as its attendant corruption, had been largely tamed. Not entirely, of course. Corruption never truly dies, but broadly, impressively, and unexpectedly. By the second decade of the 20th century, most of the excesses, patronage systems, greased palms, officials reliant on pay-for-play schemes across the country, had clearly been tackled. And that process of unwinding endemic American corruption points to the kind of multifaceted approach that will work for those of us now staring down this second Gilded Age. Those anti-corruption reforms of the late 19th and early 20th centuries didn't happen overnight. They took years and a combination of factors, including expanded oversight, significant investigations, increased government regulations, and even select high-profile prosecutions. Civil service reform, which prioritized merit over patronage in government hiring, helped stanch corrupt networks at the federal level. Federal prosecutions of those paying and receiving bribes, creating a new era of criminal enforcement, as one scholar said, launched new pro-transparency efforts across the U.S. Combined with new anti-corruption legislation, increased election finance transparency, pro-transparency reforms in the lobbying sector, and beefed-up regulatory oversight bodies, the U.S. lurched from the bog of the Gilded Age into a more equitable and more transparent time, one that we now know as the Progressive Era. Toward the end of the 2010s, the calls for a new progressive era became impossible to miss. In the U.S., the calls manifested themselves in a revitalized left, fired by the presidential campaigns of Senator Bernie Sanders and a new roster of congressional leaders. While Sanders' campaigns eventually flamed out, his imprint on broader policy will long outlast him. An entire slate of policy proposals, all centered on rising wealth and income inequality, have glommed on to American political discourse and have proved impossible to dislodge. Things like a wealth tax, which would target substantial holdings of the richest among us. Things like a return to a progressive taxation policy, such as the kind America boasted during the post-World War II period and which disintegrated amid broader deregulatory reforms. Things like bills specifically targeting the marriage between illicit finance, oligarchy, and the decline of democracy more broadly. Around the world, we have witnessed the rise of demagogues who, once in power, use their positions to loot the state of its resources, Sanders said in 2017, adding a year later that we need to understand that the struggle for democracy is bound up with the struggle against kleptocracy and corruption. If nothing else, Sanders, alongside politicos like Senator Elizabeth Warren, has clarified the relationship between kleptocracy and runaway, unregulated capitalism in a way few have. Because at the end of the day, kleptocracy can be understood in many ways as capitalism at its rawest, or as capitalism at its worst. Capitalism unburdened by requirements for transparency or disclosure. Capitalism in which wealth can open any door needed without any safeguard in place. Capitalism in which brutal ruling classes, as we've seen in Russia and Kazakhstan, in China and Venezuela, in Equatorial Guinea and pre-revolution Ukraine, capture the levers of state power and all the wealth that comes with it to entrench their regimes forevermore and to kill off any democratizing efforts along the way. And a capitalism that allows those regimes to turn to the U.S. whenever they need to take advantage of American financial secrecy, keeping their looted wealth safe and secure. And maybe, as Trump illustrated, even using it to help place a man servicing their kleptocratic needs directly in the White House. But if we're to enter a new progressive era, one to undo the devastation of this American kleptocracy, there's one other lesson to heed from a more recent point in American history. As Carl Levin and his staff highlighted during the passage of the post-9/11 reforms, none of the success they found would have been possible if the legislation hadn't already been ready. If legislators hadn't already crafted detailed plans to block off American financial institutions from dirty money, the small window of opportunity following the September 11 attacks would have shut, with little to show for it. If legislators hadn't been ready, American banks, those original progenitors of American kleptocracy, would have continued working with whomever they wanted, however they wanted, cycling billions and billions in dirty money. Instead, because Levin and his staff were prepared, America showed how an entire banking sector could be cleaned up and could shine a path forward for others. All because legislators like Levin were ready. Levin retired in 2015, but a new crop of counter-kleptocracy activists has emerged in Washington, working with civil society and legislators to craft bills that can tackle these financial secrecy industries and restore the U.S.'s leadership status in the world of anti-corruption efforts. In the civil society sector, groups like Transparency International, Global Witness, the FACT Coalition, and the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative, the latter, where I'm an adjunct fellow, led by new thinkers like Nate Sibley, have collated all these kleptocratic issues into a comprehensive structure and comprehensive story, bundling recommendations to both legislators and experts alike. Helped along by investigative journalists at places like the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, ICIJ, and the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, these groups have all assisted in fleshing out our understanding of modern kleptocracy, as well as how to combat it. And in Congress, the Helsinki Commission, an independent, bipartisan federal commission focused on human rights and pro-democracy policies, has become the unofficial home for the counter-kleptocracy brain trust. Led by policy analyst Paul Massaro, himself a font of bottomless pro-democracy energy, the Helsinki Commission has launched bill after bill to begin patching up America's counter-kleptocracy regime. Massaro, alongside legislators like Rhode Island Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, has picked up the baton from Levin in Washington and has joined with Sibley and others, including luminaries and anti-corruption forces like Ben Judah, Elise Bean, Josh Rudolph, Abigail Bellows, Clark Gascoigne, and Jody Vittori, among plenty more, to usher in a new guard of counter-kleptocracy efforts in the U.S., bridging partisan gaps and stitching together policy proposals that have gained widening audiences on both sides of the political aisle. Indeed, it's that bipartisan nature of the new counter-kleptocracy cohort that presents perhaps the greatest reason for hopes of reform. The bill to ban anonymous shell companies, for instance, came with numerous co-sponsors, from arch-conservative voices like Senator Tom Cotton to Democratic stalwarts like Senator Bob Menendez, threading liberal and conservative supporters alike. Not that bipartisan support should necessarily be that surprising. After all, Levin enjoyed bipartisan support for his anti-money laundering thrusts at the PSI. And legislators across the political spectrum have all seen how their constituents have suffered as the tentacles of these offshoring networks have reached into communities, crept into industries, and upended and uprooted everything from national security to American elections themselves. These counter-kleptocracy policies can and should be a bipartisan endeavor. Because while progressive, pro-transparency legislation is demanded on this front, the policies detailed earlier would also present a restoration of American leadership on the global stage and an extension of historic American leadership in the anti-corruption space. From the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, FCPA, to Levin's banking regulations, from creating FARA to cracking open the Swiss banking sector, the U.S. had claimed the torch of anti-corruption leadership for decades. Trump may have tried to snuff it out, but the flame burns still, and it's clear that without American leadership, the efforts to end the broader world of offshoring, or of transnational money laundering, or of rising oligarchies and oligopolies, both foreign and domestic, will ultimately fail. And without these much-needed efforts, there is little hope for the broader liberal democratic projects around the world. Because the thing that ties all the modern anti-American, anti-democratic regimes and movements together around the globe isn't some illiterate, blinkered ideology like communism, or a moral grotesquerie like fascism. It is, instead, greed, rampaging, unrepentant, unalloyed, embodied by the ruling regimes entrenched in the pursuit of power and an ever-expanding pocketbook. It's a kleptocratic greed we've already seen take root in Moscow, with Putin and his cronies clinging to power, posing as Russian nationalists in order to siphon off billions for themselves. It's a kleptocratic greed we've seen spread through Beijing, where the officials and the family members connected to the ruling Chinese Communist Party have transformed themselves into little more than a gluttonous regime dedicated to pillaging the Chinese people and leading to a genocide against minority ethnicities like Uyghurs along the way. It's a kleptocratic greed we've seen subsume regimes in Caracas and Tehran and Pyongyang. It's a kleptocratic greed we've seen wherever a democracy has tilted into illiberal authoritarianism or where dictatorships already rule. It's a kleptocratic greed, unmitigated and unceasing, that now presents the greatest threat to the U.S. and its democratic allies. As journalist Oliver Bullough once wrote, "Kleptocracy is for the 21st century what fascism and communism were for much of the 20th. And he's right. The only difference, this transnational threat isn't emanating from Moscow or Berlin or Beijing or Rome. It is instead reliant on and sustained by the kleptocratic services the U.S. provides in droves, which outpace even those provided by the traditional offshore havens of yore, and which offer the keys to this kleptocratic kingdom to whoever comes knocking, even to those who'd prefer to knock down the entire house of liberal democracy itself." Which is why this fight to end offshoring and financial secrecy and modern kleptocracy begins here, at home. It begins in states like Delaware and Nevada, Wyoming and South Dakota, which have all opened their doors to the torrent of dirty money racing in, helping hide and obscure it for anyone around the world. It begins with legislators pushing policies like those crafted by Massaro and the Helsinki Commission. And it begins in the public square, with Americans pushing back against the lobbyists for the hedge funds and private equity and real estate industries, all of which have gorged themselves at the table of American anonymity, offering their laundering services to kleptocrats, destabilizing countries, immiserating populations, devastating ecologies, brutalizing women and children, and threatening democracy on this planet. Whatever differences once existed between offshore and onshore have collapsed, disintegrated by those in the U.S. who transformed the country into the biggest financial secrecy haven of them all. What was once offshore is now here, beached in the middle of America, surrounding all of us, still, for many, too big to see. Hopefully, though, this book has helped illuminate some of the kleptocracy that is all around us, because it's here, in the U.S., that it can end. And it has to. For if it doesn't, it's not only the end of liberal democracy, but also the imposition of a new global feudalism, a kind of Hobbesian capitalism in its most disgusting, most uncut form, where all ends justify all means, and where a new caste of the wealthiest detach from the rest of society, disappearing their riches into the offshore, onshore world, bankrolling anything and everything that suits their needs, all while blocking any efforts at transparency, reform, or regulatory oversight. It's a world whose outline, in America, and in so many other places alongside, we can already detect. But there's still time to prevent that future. Time to implement the policies long overdue, and to restore American leadership in the anti-corruption and counter-kleptocracy space. Time to bring transparency to worlds and entire money laundering industries that thrive on anonymity. Time for us to finally end this American kleptocracy, before this American kleptocracy ends everything else worth saving. This is Joe Dwyer. Thank you for listening to American Kleptocracy, written by Casey Michelle, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press, produced by Callum Plews. Text copyright 2021 by Casey Michelle. Production copyright 2021 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.